That is a fine question. Folks in Oklahoma, Texas, Wisconsin, and Minnesota are wondering the very same thing. Flash flooding is a key topic on this week's Jet Streaming. This is Jet Streaming from Minnesota Public Radio. We are devoted to all matters meteorological. I'm Kathy Werzer, along with co-hosts Paul Huttner, Minnesota Public Radio's chief meteorologist.
Hi, Kathy.
How are you?
Good.
And our friend Mark Seely is back. He's from the University of Minnesota. We missed you.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
You arrived just in time to see the end of the drought, at least in southern Minnesota. Well, maybe.
Maybe. We'll see.
Also with us, Craig Edwards, former chief of the National Weather Service office in Chanhassen, Minnesota. Good to talk with you, my friend.
Good morning, Kathy.
We want to talk about what's been happening in the upper Midwest here the past, couple of days. Severe flooding in southeastern Minnesota and southwestern Wisconsin. Joining us right now is Glenn Lusky. He's the chief meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Kathy.
When did your folks know this was going to be a flood of historic proportions?
Well, I don't know if we know in terms of historic proportions, probably until you're kind of in the middle of the event. We knew that there was a threat for significant rainfall and significant flooding, and we had put out statements a few days prior to that. But I tell you what, when the way things set up and getting some preconditioning rains on Saturday with a couple inches, and then the heavy stuff comes in Saturday night, I tell you, I went and read my rain gauge about 8 or 9 p.m., and I saw about 6 inches or 7 inches in there, and I'm thinking to myself at that time, we got some problems. And then it kept coming, and obviously we've all seen the results.
Now, Craig Edwards, you are no stranger when it comes to forecasting flood conditions. Maybe you and Glenn want to talk about what transpired.
Yeah, Kathy, what was setting up, of course, Glenn knows the antecedent conditions, and the National Weather Service, the River Forecast Center, puts out flash flood guidance values, and typically those are around 3 inches. So we know historically when you get a 3-inch rainfall, you've got flooding that's going to be underway. Now, the problem is the National Weather Service goal and the mission is to give lead time on those flash flood events. So instead of having a warning come out that says flash flooding is being reported, you want to get a warning out that says flash flooding is about to occur or imminent. And I think in this situation, Glenn knowing 6 inches of rain is going to be a very problematic issue. The warning, I understand, it came out several hours before the event really got precarious and catastrophic. So the challenge we have at the National Weather Service is the discontinuity, if you will, of what constitutes a flash flood. Normally you think of a wall of water and what we saw down in southeast Minnesota and southwest Wisconsin, but a lot of areas of the state are flat and maybe you only have flash flooding if you have poor drainage or basement type flooding. But in this situation, we definitely have identified southeast Minnesota and southwest Wisconsin due to the terrain as the most problematic when it comes to flash flooding. The National Weather Service has a program called FFMP, Flash Flood Monitoring and Prediction, that integrates the River Center's antecedent or flash flood potential based on a rainfall possibility and the observed conditions on the radar. Glenn, how did that work for you guys on Saturday night down there in La Crosse?
Well, the FFMP program, as you know, Craig, too, it's a huge asset to the flash flood program. And the way it works is it takes the reflectivity values that are coming in and integrates that with time. It is estimating precipitation every 5 minutes, basically, and integrating that with time. And as that data comes in, and you can see it on your scope there, you're getting estimates of maybe 3-4 inches based off of the radar. And as you had mentioned, Craig, the River Forecast Center guidance, typically 2-4 inches indicating potential for flooding based on the antecedent conditions. It gives you a really good feel, even down to the basin, to the river basin, even the very small basins, the creek level, of where the heaviest rain has fallen, where the biggest threats are, and that was a huge asset to seeing where we needed to issue the warnings. And like you said, we had warnings out for really the two worst counties in our area, Winona and Houston, where we had the fatalities. Those warnings were out probably 3 hours ahead of time before the first reports of major damage and really bad situations there.
Glenn, Mark Seely, I wanted to ask, associated with this episode on the weekend, Can you recall what the 24 and 48-hour QPF products were showing, the quantified precipitation forecast products?
I don't want to err by saying something incorrect there. I know that they were showing a couple of inches. We had some challenges that some of the models were showing the rainfall farther north, some were farther south, and it was very difficult to pinpoint prior to the event exactly where this was going to set up. And when you have situations like that, you don't want to go all out, so let's say, with your forecast and say, okay, we're looking for 4 or 5 inches in one specific area. It generally tends to be a little more broad brush and a little lower amounts, even though you know probably somewhere you're going to get some very high amounts through there. Once we saw it setting up across southern Minnesota, we had a pretty good feel that area was going to be the most problematic area. So, yeah, the QPF forecast 24, 48 hours ahead of time, it gives you a general area, but it may not give you the precise area or maybe as high as some of the reports that are going to be that come in.
Glenn and Mark, I was looking at some of those HPC QPF charts in the day and or so preceding the flood, and you're right, exactly. They set up that corridor of heavy rain from Ortonville right through about Wilmer and the Twin Cities at first. It appeared it would be a little bit north of your area, and then gradually, eventually shifted that some to the south. Overall, the setup was a classic flash flood setup. We had the stationary boundary down to the south. We had a lot of what we call warm air advection transporting that deep tropical moisture up and over that boundary, and a lot of upper air support with that. Bottom line, we knew there was going to be heavy rain. It was extremely difficult to pinpoint. In general, how tough is it to pinpoint when a 40 or 50 mile difference can make all the difference in the world? These heavy rain corridors, and what do you think about any sort of boost or turbocharge from any additional moisture from what once was Tropical Storm Erin?
Well, I think you're right that pinpointing the exact location is really one of the biggest challenges when you know you have the setup, you know you're in a classic flash flood type of a situation with back building storms. In other words, storms say moving one direction, but they're building on the backside and just regenerating there. So I think that's really the issue, and it gets down to identifying when you see it happening, where you see that line developing. Okay, now you can get a little better feel for, okay, here's the area that I think we're going to have to watch out most closely for. So that really reduces the amount of time you can get in terms of being specific there. In terms of a boost to the precipitation, I think that on the backside of the ridge that we've had set up over the southeast there and getting some of that moisture in from Texas and so on, that deep tropical moisture, it probably did have an impact in terms of what was available to come up over the frontal boundary and into the area.
Final question from Craig Edwards.
Yeah, Glenn, I want to compliment your office because over the years I've seen you guys play a lot of meteorologists. This, you got a very good science officer. And what we try to do in the Weather Service is try not to get hysterical about an event that's not going to be a big deal. And I know I'm looking at a map of weather.gov that's showing flash flood watches and warnings all the way from Worthington, Minnesota to Philadelphia, a map of green. And I know somewhere in between there's going to be a lot of rain. But over the course of a flash flood season, you tend to see these green things show up on a map, and then you don't hear anything cataclysmic. So there's a real fine line about raising the awareness and a concern from an event where you have some water over the roadways and you have a calamity like you have in southeast Minnesota. So very tough issue to deal with.
You know, it is a fine line, and as you know, flash floods, they come in all shapes and sizes, and it might be, you know, okay, where is the boundary between an urban flood where you've got a lot of water that just can't get through the sewer systems in an urban area, and when does it become a flash flood? So you're going to have issues there that you have to deal with. I think that the awareness thing, and as I was traveling around southeast Minnesota the last 2 days here and talking to people and hearing some amazing stories of heroism from some of the emergency personnel, and really those are some of the incredible stories that would be very interesting, I think, to track. But when you see see that. And the thing that struck out to me was the fact that you didn't get the message out to everybody and people that needed to know. And that I think in there, weather radio is probably the most important thing that we can emphasize here, because power was out in many places. People didn't know through the media that what was going on. And if they had their weather radios, they would have known. They would have been aware of what was going on there. And the second part of it is people's response to the warnings. There were emergency personnel that were trying to evacuate people from low-lying areas, from campgrounds, and they would not leave. And eventually they had to go in and pluck them out of trees. So I think that the real message is be able to get the information in a way at a time when maybe you don't have power, and weather radio is the way to do that. Mm-hmm. And secondly, obviously heed the warnings. Listen to your emergency personnel and get out of harm's way, because with flooding, it's the major killer. It's the number one killer in the United States every year. Many people don't realize that. And, in this kind of an event where you've got 10 to 17 inches, it can be disastrous.
Well, Glenn, we really appreciate you joining us. Thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure.
We've been talking to Glenn Lusky. He's the National Weather Service Chief Meteorologist in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Yeah, some of us get a little down when it's raining. Likewise, when the sun's out, our mood might get more of a lift. It's becoming more clear that the weather and climate can affect the well-being of all living creatures. And the scientific study of those effects is called biometeorology. I don't know why I can't pronounce that word right now, gentlemen. Joining us to talk about this exciting field of study is Dr. Scott Green with the International Society of Biometeorology. He's with the University of Oklahoma in Norman. Obviously, Scott, I'm having some problems this morning. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, I guess it's easier to define than it is to say.
I guess so. So when you're at cocktail parties, when you're chatting with folks, how do you define your field of study?
I think that simply saying the linkages between climate and health is the way that I look at it. Now, it's health of all things, whether it's chickens or slugs or, hantavirus or people. But really that's what it boils down to. So well-being is a fancy word for just saying how do we feel or react when the weather changes.
Scott, Mark Seeley here. I wanted to ask you, I see your resume shows a fair amount of work in the study and consequence of heat on human health, as well as air quality or air pollution on human health. Do you think that there's any trends present in the North American continent, for example, with respect to the frequency that heat comes into play, particularly in our major cities?
Well, I think that certainly the urban heat island phenomenon, where the center of the cities has been getting hotter, has contributed to increased mortality over time. That is somewhat mitigated by air conditioning. That there are places now that used to have air conditioning that didn't. But if you look at the inner cities, and by the way, that's where people die. I should also add that our studies have shown that it's heat by far. Heat is by far the number one killer. You add up everything else, and they don't come to where heat is. So I heard the previous person talking about flooding, and flooding is important. But heat's the number one weather-related killer by far. As far as trends go, I think that you look at over the last 50 years, just because of increased urbanization, increased urban heat island phenomenon, and then you have more frequent severe heat waves overall, it's going up. Now, that's mitigated by cities are beginning to do things to reduce heat-related fatalities, and there are things like air conditioners and so forth. But if you look over certainly the last 50 years, and you look at cases like Chicago or certainly the European heat wave in 2003, you just see it going up.
Scott, Paul Huttner here. The critters that run around us that we love to watch, some of the folklore, the woolly bear caterpillars, of course, the old saying is if it has a wide brown band in the middle, the coming winter will be milder. If it's a narrow band, it could be more harsh. Now, I've seen studies, of course, that show there's really no correlation with that. But any comments on the woolly bear or any other indicators in nature that seem to foretell seasonal weather accurately?
I would say that if you look 6 or 9 months out, they do no worse than we do in forecasting climate or seasonal variability. There's not a statistical relationship, as you pointed out, but that's not much worse than what climate forecasters do 6 months out if we're trying to tie an El Nino or whatever. As far as any precursors, I can't really think of any example. I mean, there's lots of folklore, and in some places there's, you know, some reliance on that, but as far as any scientific study, I'm afraid I can't say of any one that really stands out as being meaningful in terms of a precursor or a predictor.
Is the main key, Scott, when it comes to the effects of the weather on a human, say the atmospheric pressure?
It's really, I mean, heat is the most important thing. So I'm talking about on a day-to-day basis. I mean, if you live in L.A. or you live in Houston, you're more likely to get emphysema because of air quality. That's not a day-to-day phenomenon. But day-to-day, it's really, really heat. And when I talk about heat, I mean, you have to realize that when we walk outside or a mosquito is buzzing around outside, what it experiences is the air. And the air is, let's take the summer, the air is not just temperature, it's humidity, it's minimum temperature at night. The heat wave in Memphis, for example, minimum temperature at night has been very important in killing a lot of people, unfortunately. It's all of those things, wind, whether or not we're sitting in the sun or in the shade. Pressure is a component of that, but it's really a holistic look at the air and all those variables.
In our region, Scott, some feel that here in the Western Great Lakes area, we're seeing increased frequency of air quality problems. And there's been some speculation about whether or not there's been change in the frequency and strength of inversion layers that develop and therefore constrict the volumetric mixing of those constituents in the atmosphere. Have you read or done any research that has looked at the pattern in terms of inversions and what its effect might be relative to air quality?
Well, not specifically in your area. I can't address that. I do know that if you look globally, minimum temperatures at night have been going up. And that's probably, other than the Arctic, that's probably the biggest, I think, global warming signal is minimum temperatures at night. And if you have still air and increasing minimum temperatures and increasing dew point, you're more likely to see inversion-like conditions, and obviously that traps the air. I think the problem is that in most cities where you're looking at air quality, that urbanization plays such a key role. It's very hard to mask out, you know, urban change or urban patterns to atmospheric patterns. But I do know that let me put it this way. I do know that conditions that would be conducive to increased inversions have been going up. I know in some places they've been going up, but I don't know specifically about how that links to air quality in Minnesota, for example.
Well, Scott, I know you have to go teach class. We really appreciate you joining us. Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
That is Scott Green with the International Society of Biometeorology. Boy, I'm really messing that up today. He's at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. How many times have I said meteorology? And I can't say it today.
It's harder to say than it sounds.
It must be. It's the atmosphere affecting me. This is what's happening.
It could be a direct effect.
It could be a direct
effect. Blame it on the weather.
I think I will. Thank you very much. Let us please, let's move on to the weather website of the week. Yes. Get the thunder and the lightning and the rain in here. Dr. Seeley, what would be that weather website of the week?
Well, I tried to think of something appropriate for flash flooding and those that might be concerned about monitoring all the wet weather and the consequence of the wet weather. And I came across the U.S. Geological Survey Water Watch site. If you Google on those words, it's going to lead you right to that website. What's fascinating to me about that website, Kathy, is for all the watersheds in the U.S., you can actually pull up the real-time flows on those watersheds, the gauged flow values, and it also frames those in historical context. So areas that have suffered recently from heavy rainfalls and perhaps even extremes of flash flooding, you can see how those flows on those watersheds rank historically and whether or not they're new records or maybe in the top 5% or something like that. So very interesting website to look at if your particular region of the U.S. has been suffering from heavy rainfalls.
So it's water.usgs.gov/waterwatch.
That's right.
Okay, all one word. Well, low flow is not the case in parts of Texas, Oklahoma, and Wisconsin, and of course, Minnesota. You know, let's bring Craig Edwards back in here, by the way. When you experts look at the events of this past summer, drought, severe flooding, what do you all think about? Do you wonder what the heck is going on?
Kathy, I think back that I think it was in May that Aberdeen had like 12 inches of rain. And then it got into early June, it sort of shut off, and the moisture just shut off, and we just couldn't get rain. And I think Mark has talked about this, that once you set up a pattern and you got drought begets drought and wetness begets wetness, we finally got this rain that's been dumping volumes of rain on Iowa to shift a little bit north. Now we just got to expand that. We still got to deal with the drought that's going on in the Arrowhead region along the North Shore and portions of northern Wisconsin. So while we're down here suffering with very damp and flood conditions in southern Minnesota, we still have very dry conditions up in the north with the fire restrictions and still in the boundary water area.
I think, Kathy, what conjures up in my mind is that, and it's very disconcerting actually, is since the 1990s, the climate modeling research community has told us that a signal of climate change will be an amplified precipitation variability, and that the extremes will become more evident. We will get extremely wet, extremely dry. And sure enough, if we look at most of the hydrologic features across our region, and for that matter, widespread across the mid-latitudes in the northern hemisphere, that amplified hydrologic signal is present, where we're seeing many areas of the landscape extremely wet and many areas extremely dry. And that's very disconcerting, because when you think about adapting to that as a society, that poses some big challenges.
Mm. Yeah, Paul Huttner?
I think we've had three summers this year. The transitions have been incredibly rapid, as if somebody flipped a switch, to kind of dovetail on what Mark was saying. In the first part of the summer, after winter, remember the April snows early in April?
Yeah.
Very cold winter extended into the first part of the month.
Yes.
April 15th, if you look back at the record, somebody flipped a switch, and we went into spring and almost early summer-like weather within just a few weeks. And Craig Edwards and I were responsible at that time for covering the whole Minnesota Public Radio warning network. And we were on the air almost every day for about 2 months with severe thunderstorm warnings. Beyond that, the switch flipped again. We went into drought. We couldn't buy a drop of rain across most of Minnesota for a couple of months. And then again, a week ago Saturday, the switch flipped one more time. We had those severe storms roll into the metro early in the wee hours of the morning. We got them again the following Monday night, and then this tragic and historic flood in southeast Minnesota, all within a period of about 9 days. So it has been a summer of not only extremes, but extremely rapid transitions. It's almost been like we've had three different summers here this year.
It certainly has been an interesting summer, though. It's been good fodder for jet streaming, that's for sure.
We've had plenty to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
No kidding. Well, Craig, we'll talk to you later. Thanks.
Sounds good, Kathy.
And thank you, Mark and Paul.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thank
you. Appreciate you coming in. And that's going to wrap up Jet Streaming for the week. Jet Streaming is produced by Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kathy Werzer. Now, we really want to hear from listeners. Why do you listen? What information is most valuable to you, and how can we improve this podcast? Drop us a line at minnesotapublicradio.org. Go to Jet Streaming in the podcast section. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.
Keep on the sunny side.